Chance in Cape Town course. And today I'm really pleased to present Greg Ullesser. Greg is the Head of Environmental Policy and Strategy for the City of Cape Town. He also has a master's degree, a conservation biology master's degree from the City of Cape Town, and is actually involved with a range of environmental issues for the city, which range from dealing with climate change and rising sea levels to sharks. But today, Greg's going to concentrate on his role in the city in dealing with the shark issue and provide some current information on the exclusion net and other programs that the city is involved in. So please welcome Greg.
Good afternoon. As Alison said, I'm Greg Ullesser from the City of Cape Town. From the city's perspective, sharks and shark-related issues, I'm responsible for those. So Alison asked me to speak today a little bit about the city's perspective on sharks, and that relates very much to our perspective on the shark attacks that we've experienced recently in the last decade in Cape Town. But more explicitly, to try and talk a little bit about the context of sharks and shark attacks and how they impact on our city, and describe as best as I can the approach that the city has adopted in that regard, what we're doing about it, and some of the challenges that we face on a daily basis in terms of that approach that we've adopted. So I've titled my talk, Emotion and Perception Trump Statistics, because I think a lot of what I want to talk about today is really this phenomenon of fear around sharks, and that's probably one of the biggest drivers in terms of how we respond to shark attacks, the importance of shark attacks, how shark attacks get such significant media coverage when they do happen, and they're a very topical issue amongst people. So there's a lot more to sharks than really the science of sharks and the pure statistics. It's a lot around human emotion and the way that we as humans respond to sharks. So a little bit of background and history in terms of Cape Town. Looking back historically as an overarching approach, sharks were really never an issue in Cape Town. So between 1900 and 1960, there were only really 9 reported shark attacks, and it's likely to be some underreporting in that, because in the last century, reporting and collection of data and people monitoring this kind of thing was probably a bit less efficient than it is now. But fundamentally, the picture was that shark attacks were a very rare occurrence in Cape Town, and between 1985 and 2000, we were only aware of 2 attacks. Neither of them were fatal. And most of the shark interaction, or people, human shark interaction, took place primarily in terms of big game fishing. There was quite a lot of active fishing in False Bay by people targeting white sharks for sport fishing, and some of the spear fishermen would now and then encounter white sharks. And linked to that as well was our knowledge of sharks in Cape Town. And fundamentally before 2000, and the work that primarily has been done by Alison and her colleagues, and I think you heard a lot about that yesterday and the day before, we had little or no knowledge around this, particularly the seasonal variation of shark presence in False Bay, that there's this very strong trend between winter and summer. And also, we had very little knowledge that Cape Town was, in fact, a global hotspot for white sharks, and Seal Island was the kind of center point around this. And it was only in the late 1990s that Seal Island was really identified as this place where this phenomenal breaching activity took place on seals, and that during winter it was really a strong point of congregation for white sharks. So really, before the year 2000, white sharks was very low on the agenda in Cape Town as a whole. It was not something that was spoken about a lot, and we seemed to have very little knowledge around white sharks. Linked to that as well as 2 other things. One is there was no structure within Cape Town in any sphere of government in terms of looking at sharks from a safety perspective. So in KwaZulu-Natal, they've had this long history of the KwaZulu-Natal Sharks Board that's been around for more than 40 years. So there's kind of an institutional framework that was responsible for white sharks, or not white sharks, for sharks and shark safety and bather issues. In Cape Town, there was none of that. So there was nobody that was responsible for white shark safety up until 2000. And also, I think there was a general sense amongst users in Cape Town, which we now know not to be true, but that Cape Town had cold water, so sharks were not really an issue in Cape Town, and sharks were something you thought about when you went to warm water environments like Durban, etc. So up until 2000, sharks were not really a very topical issue, not really on the agenda, and not something that we were too worried about at all. But something changed, and this is probably the reason why. Between 2000 and 2012, so in the last 12 years, we've had 17 shark attacks in Cape Town. Of those, 5 have been fatal. So in 12 years, we've had almost triple the number of shark attacks that we reported in the previous century. So there was this sudden shift. And linked to that as well was a change in many things. And for myself, in terms of being involved in this process, The period between September 2003 and July 2005 was really a key point where there was a fundamental change in terms of Cape Town and the consideration of white sharks. And the reason for that, I think, is twofold. One, during that period, we had three really bad shark attacks, which were all fatal, but they were really horrific in their nature. We had a bodyboarder killed at Nordic Beach in September of 2003. We had a shark attack on J.P. Andrew, which was not fatal, but he lost his limb at Musenberg Corner while surfing. Tyner Webb was killed at Fishhook, and then a spear fisherman was killed at Miller's Point. And we had all of that take place in 20 months. But I think it wasn't just the fact that we had those fatalities and those shark attacks that shifted perceptions quite quickly. It was the fact that those shark attacks were really bad in their nature. Two of those people were consumed. They were eaten, which is an unusual occurrence. But also those attacks took place at very popular beaches historically considered very safe. So it was almost like there was this intrusion into this perceived safe space where for many people, they will tell you that they've swum at Fishhook for 50 years, never seen a shark. They would swim across the bay, but never sharks. And suddenly, here was this really horrible shark attack that took place right in Fishhook. But also, particularly for Mrs. Webb, the attack on Mrs. Webb and also on J.P. Andrew, both of those attacks took place and was witnessed by very many people. So a very traumatic event, was seen by a lot of people in terms of what was happening in the water. And so suddenly, there was this fundamental change. But I think linked to that as well was, in a parallel process, but I think that started shifting that perception, was at the same time we really saw the growth in the cage diving industry, and I'm not suggesting for a moment that there's a relationship or link between the two, but rather there was this growth in this industry that we started recognizing that we were a real hotspot for white shark activity. There was some of this significant interest in white sharks. There was a whole tourism industry that was building around it. We also started seeing a massive amount of TV documentaries that were filmed at Seal Island in False Bay that were suddenly on our TVs every night, so everybody was being more exposed to breaching white sharks at Seal Island. I think one of the first documentaries was called Air Jaws. So in a parallel process, we suddenly had white sharks attacking people in previously considered very safe areas, very publicly, if I can use that, in terms of a front of a lot of people, so very traumatic. And at the same time, there was a lot of information coming through around the fact that actually Cape Town did have a lot of sharks, or relatively so, and we had big sharks. So I think suddenly, as a result of those two things from my experience, that period of time was really a turning point in terms of how we think about sharks in Cape Town, and in fact put great white sharks on the agenda topically, in terms of the social perspective, as from my own perspective, where if I go out to a dinner party and people find out what I do, I'll end up speaking about sharks the whole night. Everybody's interested in it. But also from a perspective of where I work, suddenly the sharks were something that, where I work, there was a response that was required. Something needed to be done. And we weren't geared up for that. It was not something that I was expecting at the time to be involved in. So there was that fundamental period of time change that, from my perspective, kind of sets the scene for everything that's happened in Cape Town since then. So a little bit, and a lot of this stuff is anecdotal. Unfortunately, if we had known retrospectively that there would be that change, we could have collected fantastic information to show the shift in how that has affected human behavior. But I think we've got strong anecdotal information to be able to talk about those kinds of changes. So fundamentally, as a result of that shift, in my view, certainly anyway, we've seen a significant change in the way that people use the water, particularly in False Bay. So around about 1999-2000, surf skiing and kayaking really took off in Cape Town. And especially on a beautiful winter's morning with no wind, you would see this long train of paddlers paddling between Fishhook and Musenberg, and there were a lot of people out paddling. You don't see that anymore. You still have the sort of hardcore competitive surf skiers who will do the Miller's Run and those kinds of competitive events, but the general user who wants to go for a light, casual paddle and paddle from Musenberg to Fishhook, that's stopped. People don't do that anymore. Recreational beach use has changed, certainly at Fishhook. For a long time, people used to swim out to a buoy along Jagger's Walk. It was a morning swim. They don't do that anymore. People will still swim at Fishhook, but they'll generally not swim much more than waist or chest deep. So the way that they've utilized that beach has certainly changed. We had a strong culture in Cape Town historically of open water swimming competitions. So there was the Fishhook Mile, which was a sort of famous annual event. There were a number of other open water swimming events where people would swim from Simonstown to Fishhook, around the lighthouse and back to Fishhook. There was this number of events. There are no more open water swimming events in False Bay. And certainly from a life-saving club's perspective, is probably where one of the biggest impacts has taken place, is that there's most certainly been a change in the uptake, particularly in the Nipper range of lifesavers in terms of training, is that there's a fear from parents and from young children in terms of having to swim in deep water because of sharks in False Bay. But I think the most indicative of that change, and that it really indicates that this isn't really a Cape Town phenomenon, was when Kushuk Life Saving Club won the right to host the South African Life Saving Championships. The rest of the clubs in the rest of the country said, if you hold it at Fishhook, we won't come. So they had to hold it at Camps Bay. So it wasn't, it's more indicative that that sense of threat extended well beyond the borders of Cape Town, and in fact permeated the entire country in terms of life-saving clubs saying, well, if you're going to host something at Fishhook, we won't come. And so a different decision had to be made. So I think that gives us a little bit of context in that some of the stuff is very difficult to measure and be explicit about, but I think there's a lot of anecdotal information that the shift in our thinking around great white sharks in Cape Town has certainly had an impact in terms of how we view and use our coastline. So coming from that is really, from my perspective, is two key questions. Is the public concern and change behavior justified? So are we overreacting in terms of white sharks? And really linked to that, are sharks and shark attacks really an issue? So should we be investing in shark safety measures? I get asked often, from my perspective, you know, should we be putting so much money into shark spotting and other measures? Is it not an overreaction? And I think there's two ways to look at that. And certainly from a statistical point of view, I think it's absolutely factual that compared to the daily risks that we face, shark attacks are a non-issue. They really are. You know, I did a very coarse and crude calculation, but roughly between the year 2000 and 2012, if we consider the number of shark attacks on surfers and the number of surfers utilizing the water on a daily basis throughout the year, we probably averaged about one shark attack point per 1.35 million hours of surfing, or 150 years of surfing for shark attacks. So in terms of those kind of statistics, you know, the reality is shark attacks in comparison, so not looking at them in isolation as an event in itself, but compared to driving your car on a busy road and a whole lot of other things that I'll talk about in a little bit now, in terms of the risk we all face daily, shark attacks are a non-issue from a statistical point of view. But I think the key thing from our perspective is that you can't look at it simply from a statistical point of view, because in doing that you ignore a very fundamental component of being human, is that human nature, emotions and perceptions don't respond in line with statistics. If they did that, most of us wouldn't drive our cars during the festive season, because that's the highest car crash rate. We had, I think, 1,400 fatalities this festive season, and we generally don't respond to those kinds of statistics. We respond in very different ways from an emotional perspective, perspective of fear and what we think is risk as opposed to what is actual risk. And it's also that fear and perception of risk is driven by many factors, and we don't understand those factors really, and that's part of being human, is that we're a little bit quirky in many respects. Yes? Okay, so can you hear me now?
Yes,
okay, sorry. I'll lean closer to it. So what I was trying to say is that a little bit of this is just about being human, is that these responses to these kinds of things, we don't respond purely from a scientific or statistical point of view. And from my perspective, in terms of the job that I do, we have to try as best as we can to understand that broader concept that a lot of the stuff around sharks is driven by fear, and that fear is not something that we can put our finger on, but fear is a very important and powerful driver in terms of how people perceive things and how they respond to them and how it affects their behavior. And linked directly to that is really, from a coastal and environmental perspective, is if we ignore that human nature side of things, that often results in a cost to the environment, and I'll explain that a little bit later. So from an environmental management or conservation perspective, ignoring or reducing that fear to something to say simply it's statistically you shouldn't be worrying about it, we will often reap that reward in terms of the impact on the environment, and I'll explain that in a moment. So this is a very good campaign that was run. It was called Rethink the Shark campaign, and it really depicted, I'm sorry the picture's a bit blurry, but it depicted a number of local household items that really showed that statistic that I spoke about. This particular one is a toaster in the water, and you can't read at the bottom, but what it says is 791 faulty toasters. Faulty toasters killed 791 people last year in the world, and 4 people were killed with sharks, by sharks. So the message is very clever, it's very clear. It's basically reiterating that point that your chance of being killed by a shark is very small. But what the campaign is unable to do is to make the point that you're not scared of toasters. So it has a similar perspective with a poster with a chair floating in the water, and it makes the same statement that X number of people were killed by chairs last year, X number of people were killed by sharks. It's a very important message, it's a factual message, and it really shows us that the risk is very little. But none of you, when you walked into this hall today, were scared of the chairs that you're going to sit on. So, yes. Sorry?
We'll be surprised.
Well, you shouldn't be afraid of chairs. But the point being is that this kind of campaign is very important, and it is a very important message. So my comment is not a criticism of the campaign, but it's again to reiterate the point that sharks is this unusual phenomenon that seems to be able to generate an enormous amount of public fear or public interest in a way that we don't quite fully understand, and it has this very far-reaching effect. And simply providing those statistics to people does not shift their behavior in terms of recognizing it as the minimal threat that it really is. We also need to understand the drivers of those fears. So the media, I think, has a significant role to play, and both in a proactive manner, but also in a negative factor. These were the two headlines after the shark attack on Ahmad Hussein at Sunrise Beach in False Bay, where he lost his leg just below the knee. And the headline is Beach Death Trap, which is a very strong word, and again, it simplifies something probably more than actually what happened on the beach that day. And in Cape Times, Cape Times talks about a shark that savages a city lifesaver. In fact, it could have said the shark bit a lifesaver, and that would be a completely different perspective that's given. And that's, again, not a criticism of the newspapers, and the point I'm going to make goes beyond that, in that with the Ahmad Hussein shark attack, we monitored the Cape Argus. The Cape Argus ran a front page story on that shark attack for 10 days in a row. And I eventually asked one of the journalists why I kept it on the front page, and his response was, shark attacks sell papers. And I don't think that's an indictment on the newspapers. It's rather an indication of the public interest in things like shark attacks. So it then speaks a little bit to what I was trying to point out, that sharks tend to get this emotional stuff going from people, or this interest, whether it's morbid curiosity or, as I said, something a little bit deeper, that we genetically set up and tuned to be afraid of things that might eat us. I'm not sure what those things are, but I think it's a global phenomenon, not a South African phenomenon, that sharks and shark attacks tend to generate enormous amount of interest, enormous amount of debate, and enormous amount of discussion. So these are all the full suite of things that are part of the complex issue that we're dealing with. And we also then get the perpetuation of myths. This was a headline from The Voice, which says great whites don't eat blacks, and flats are meant so sharks won't fret us. And from my own perspective, when you read the article, I get it. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, the headline. But for many people, they read this and take that as that's what's being said. So there's all sorts of information that's being provided to people around sharks, and all of that information influences the way that people think and behave and think about sharks and respond to the shark issue as a whole. And then this picture was taken on the 5th of January at Plettenberg Bay. That's the Deakin Isle Hotel in the corner there, and there's a big white shark just below here. And this is the point that I wanted to make, that if we as conservationists and environmentalists ignore that human nature side of things, that humans are generally, not everybody, but a lot of people are afraid of sharks. It may be an irrational fear, but they are afraid of sharks. If we ignore that, we often ignore that at the cost of the sharks themselves. And what we've seen recently in Australia and Western Australia, they had 5 fatalities in a 10-month period. And they decreed that any shark seen on the inshore would be deemed an imminent threat and would be killed. So in terms of the Australian criteria, currently that white shark would be considered an imminent threat, and a kill order would be issued to remove that shark from the environment. And that's by and large a fact. From my own perspective, it's an opinion, but there's been an ignoring of the fact that there's a public sentiment around sharks. And if you don't engage with that, you get to this kind of tipping point where there's a knee-jerk reaction, a response that's required, and that response is often far exaggerated to what actually is taking place on the ground. So the other examples that I wanted to talk about, which are slightly different but also intriguing in their own way, in Reunion Island at St. Louis, which is a famous left-hand surf break, there was a fatal shark attack. There'd been a number of other shark attacks in Reunion. And the response there was quite unusual, was that the surfers went on strike. So they refused to surf at St. Lou until the government did something about the sharks. And they would prevent anybody from surfing. So this pastime of surfing at this famous surf spot in St. Lou, to bring attention to the issue, they went on strike. One of the responses from the Reunion Island was also a shark cull and killed 20 sharks. They've now shifted away from that direction. But again, it points to what I'm trying to say, which is eventually there's a response when that fear or that perceived fear gets big enough that other decision makers make decisions. And then also the famous Durban story in the Black December, that in the 1950s, which led to the establishment of the shark sport primarily, was that after the 5 attacks in a very short space of time, people packed up their cars and left the coastline. So there actually was almost like a, not a mass panic, but similar, where people packed up their holidays and went back to Johannesburg. People moved out of Durban. It was a big enough thing to create that kind of impetus, and that directly resulted in the formation of the Sharks Board down the road, and the approach that they've taken in Durban since then. But there's also a whole range of other sort of social and economic impacts and costs that are very hard to measure in terms of sharks. And some of these are less tangible and some are more measurable. But certainly from my perspective, one of the greatest privileges that we have of living in Cape Town is we've got this absolutely phenomenal coastline to enjoy and to recreate on. And from my perspective, it would be a huge disappointment and an injustice to people living in Cape Town if it became overridden by fear, that people stopped recreating and enjoying that coastline because they were afraid of it. Of course, there are always inherent risks in going in the sea, not just from sharks, from currents, waves, getting run over by somebody on a larger surfboard than you. But at the end of the day, one of the best things that we have living in Cape Town is 300 kilometers of coastline that's there for all of us to enjoy, and we should be encouraging people to enjoy it, because if people do enjoy our coastline, they value it, they value our coastline, we all look after it better. So it's a fundamental thing as part of being Capetonian is to be able to go and enjoy our coastline, and as governments, all spheres of government, we should be putting effort into making sure that people feel safe when they go and recreate in the coastline. There may not be this imminent threat, but they should feel safe so that they value that coastline and they continue to enjoy it. But also what we've seen, and I spoke a bit about the Lifesaving Club, and particularly in Cape Town, is that structures like clubs are very important in society, that there are spaces for kids to go to after school, there's extramural activities, there's important sort of social structures that happen through clubs. There's a, you know, if you're a nipper at Fishhook, you graduate from being a nipper to a more senior lifeguard, to being a professional lifeguard, you enter into competition. So these kinds of club structures along our coastline, be it from a life-saving perspective or a surf ski perspective or surfing and all of those sorts of things, they add huge value to us as a society. And one of the things that sharks tend to be able to do unwittingly, I'm sure that's not their intention, is to pose threats to the structure of those clubs, because you start having less young kids joining those clubs, their parents don't want them to become lifesavers, and so that entire club structure, which is really dependent on volunteers and people participating in the club structure, starts to dissolve and disappear. And we've seen that a little bit in Cape Town, where our life-saving clubs, some are very good and some are very active, but others are struggling, and it's a lot to do with the fact that people are more afraid, particularly from a life-saving perspective, to do a 300-meter training swim out in the open ocean. I think from Cape Town's perspective, at the grand scale, from an economic perspective, I don't believe there's been any real economic impact on Cape Town as a result of shark attacks. I think our economy is bigger than that in terms, particularly our tourism. People, in my view, and I'm open to correction, but they don't really come to Cape Town to go swim in our sea. They come to Cape Town for our beautiful landscapes, to go to Clifton Beach. The water's freezing, they might jump in the water for a short spell, but it's not really a swimming location like we have in Durban. So at that larger scale, I don't believe that shark attacks have really had a big impact, but there's certainly been an impact at the microeconomics of shark attacks. So after JP Andrew lost his leg at Musenberg, certainly for 6 months after that, the surf schools and the surfboard shops really struggled. There was a huge decrease in economic activity around that kind of stuff. And certainly if we have less people going to Fishhook or Musenberg or anywhere else because they're concerned from sharks, that transcends into less people spending money in the local cafe or at the restaurant or buying coffee or renting a sun chair, whatever the case may be. So I think the direct economic impact becomes very localized at a particular beach where the event took place, but there certainly are those impacts. And then the other last thing is the kind of social confidence. If these events are happening and people perceive that government, and again, that's all spheres of government, or the authorities are doing nothing, they're not making the place safer, there's a loss in social confidence that anything's going to be done about this. And I'll speak a little bit later, then people begin to want to take action themselves, take the problem into their own hands, and that can often be one of the worst things that can happen. So if from a government perspective, seem to do nothing, there's a decrease in the confidence and social confidence. So from a government perspective, we were really faced with a number of choices. The fact that white sharks were now something that was on the agenda, we needed to respond in some way, and from our perspective, we really had four choices. And those choices are kind of do nothing approach. Tell everybody that statistically a chance of being bitten by a shark is very, very little. You should accept going into the seas at your own risk, and really just deal with each shark attack as it comes, and provide that same information back to people. When there's a shark attack, this is an unusual event. Statistics tell us that your risk of being bitten is very, very low, and it's not an issue. From my perspective, that strategy would always place it at risk as that tipping point, where if we had a number of events in a short space of time, or there's public sentiment that something needs to happen, then the wrong decisions begin to get made. And I'll talk about some of those wrong decisions in the point number three. The alternative is to take a very conservation-centered approach and really say we place sharks and the welfare and the health of shark populations above people's recreation. It's their habitat. Our priority is to make sure that we don't interfere with that habitat. They're at the top of the pile. And as a recreational user, if you don't feel safe going in the water, don't go in the water. And that in itself, from our perspective, also points to the kind of tipping point scenario where the public eventually has enough of that. But also, and I'll speak more about that too, I feel it's a huge mistake to play the environment and people off against each other. It should never be the environment or people, it needs to be both at all times. Where we create that standoff, there's always going to be a loser, and my experience is that the environment will ultimately be the loser in that regard. The third is on the other extreme, is make beaches safe at all costs. And that links to what I said around the tipping point, is that if we decide suddenly that we need to make beaches safe at all costs, then the measures that would be implemented would really be about population control. So that's culling, that's shark nets to remove individuals from the environment. And particularly, I think, with the work that recently been published by Addison, was I'm sure spoken about yesterday, in Cape Town's context, that kind of strategy would have massive implications for the global white shark population, because on the inshore, we have female white sharks on the inshore areas. So removing those from the population would have a huge impact. Not only that, in Cape Town, we're very lucky to live in a rich environment. Deployment of shark nets, and I'll talk about that as well just now in terms of what's the difference between that and an exclusion net, but deployment of shark nets, we would see an enormous amount of bycatch from whales to seals to all sorts of other animals. So the ecological cost of that approach would be massive in terms of our city and would be really disappointing in many ways. Or we could go in terms of what Brazil did at one beach, is they simply banned swimming. So there was an area where there were a number of attacks by bull sharks, and they made it illegal to surf there. If you went and surfed there, you got pulled out by the police and were given a fine. So those are the kind of extreme measures. And I don't think any of those three options would be suitable for Cape Town, desirable, or appropriate. And so what we've tried to do from Cape Town's perspective is to drive a balanced approach. And what I mean by that is really an approach that tries is underpinned by the following nine key principles. And I'll just run through them quickly. I've spoken a lot about some of them. But really to entrench and reaffirm at all times that the real value of our coastline is as a recreational space that we can all utilize in whatever way you enjoy recreating, whether it's to go lie on the beach, swim, surf ski, walk your dog, what you like to do. We need to entrench that is one of the best things about living in Cape Town, and we need to protect that right for you to be able to enjoy that coastline. But at the same time, as part of that conversation, is to make sure that we recognize that part of that value is the unique biodiversity that makes up that coastline, is the fact that we have whales, that we have dolphin, that we have killer whales pods sometimes on our coastline. And part of that as well is this unique and really, from my perspective, huge privilege that we have these white sharks in our bay. It's absolutely, from my own perspective, when almost every night on TV you can watch a documentary on National Geographic, which is filmed at Seal Island, which is fundamentally in the middle of your city, where one of the few places in the world where you have these white sharks breaching on seals in the way that they do. That's an enormous privilege to have that right in our city. We need to, I think, recognize that and in a way really embrace that. But at the same time, in terms of doing that, is then to actively seek safety methods that we can put in place that don't have an ecological cost, but that provide the level of confidence and safety that would be meaningful for people. So it's to try and find that reasonable balance between wildlife and people, and if we can find a way to allow people and wildlife to use the same environment as best as that we can, and end up in a situation where we do get to enjoy our coastline and our sharks are safe as well. And key to that, in terms of some of those strategies, is to actively support ongoing research. And I think this week, the real big news was Addison's results around the realization that most of the sharks on the inshore are female sharks. The more we can learn about these animals, the better we can provide safety measures, both in terms of actual intervention measures, but also in terms of information. As a public, you're empowered and you have knowledge around yourself around these animals, you can make your own decisions and make better decisions. Part of our approach has been also to actively try and provide as much information as we can to the public, and I'll talk in detail what those things have been, but our attitude is exactly that, is to be open, to be honest, and to provide any information that we have about white sharks, provide that directly to the public so that you can make your own informed decision in terms of how you want to use the coastline. And key, from as I've made the point already, as under seven, is not play people off against sharks. It should never be an either or. Do we choose sharks or do we choose people? It needs to be both. And the whole time we need to remind ourselves that the discussion needs to be about both. But we got, as part of that is recognize that a shark attack is an incredibly emotional and traumatic event, especially for people who have witnessed that event. And I've experienced that by interviewing all of the people related to all the sharks that we have in Cape Town. But for the people that have been exposed to one of these events, it really is a traumatic and emotional event. And it's a tough event. It's not something that you would wish on anybody. And then lastly is to make the point that shark safety measures, in fact, if you consider the tipping point argument that I used and what's going on in Western Australia at the moment, is that appropriate shark safety measures are, in fact, a key conservation strategy. If we can keep people and sharks apart enough that it doesn't become something that there's other options that have to be put on the table, that's, in fact, in the very best interest of the sharks themselves, and to consider it in that light. So from the city's perspective, our response, and just to go through some of this in a little bit more detail, was the establishment of the shark spotting program and to fund that on an ongoing basis. So to date, we've spent invested around 8 million rand in shark spotting. We've also put, for the first time, before 2000, or in fact before 2003, there was not one sign along our coastline that mentioned a shark, which is interesting, and that again speaks to that change that I spoke about. But we now have informative as well as warning signage along our coastline. As I said, is to fund research through the shark spotting program, provide the ongoing formal information through the media and other mechanisms, and then lastly to trial an exclusion net as an option, and we're in the process of trying to get that together officially. So in terms of the detail around each of those little things, we've run the shark spotting program since 2004. To date, they've sighted 1,450 sharks, and they operate at around 8 beaches, and that's sometimes a little bit more in terms of the season where additional people come on and add to beaches. But I think one of the points that I wanted to make is the shark spotting program is not only, in my view, been very effective in terms of shark spotting at those locations, it's also got all sorts of associated benefits. So in a city like Cape Town, we've got a high levels of unemployment. The shark spotting program, although it's not a lot of jobs, has been able to create between 25 and 35 jobs on an annual basis. So it's employment for people. We've got incredible data collection as a result of that shark spotting and the collection of that data over the last 8 years, and a lot of that information was used in the recently published paper which highlighted the role of water temperature as a key determinant of sharks being in on the inshore. So very valuable scientific data is collected, not only on sharks, but the shark spotters collect data on whales and all the other things that they see in the water, so we're building this phenomenal database over the years. We also seem to have a small tourism byproduct that results of that. Our shark spotters that sit up on Boys Drive every day, the Hilton Ross bus and a whole lot of other tourism buses stop there. The people get off the bus, they speak to the shark spotter, they find out about it, so there's a point of interest from a tourism perspective. And then the kind of key question to be asked is, you know, has shark spotting worked? And from my perspective, absolutely, it's been a fantastic program, a phenomenal program, in fact. I'm not directly involved in it on a day-to-day management perspective. We have a team that does that. But to make a few points around it, it's run for the period that it has, which is around 8 years. They've been on duty 365 days of the year, every year. They've never missed a day. They're there if it rains, they're there if it's windy, they're there on Christmas, they're there on New Year. So from that perspective, it's been a phenomenal program. But almost certainly from my perspective, and I cannot prove this, and it's an opinion, but I feel justified in this opinion, they most certainly prevented a number of shark attacks, certainly at Fishhook and Musenberg, because of their presence and their ability to provide an early warning. I can't tell you that that's an absolute fact. I'm telling you that that's my opinion. But certainly we saw with the attack on Mr. Michael Cohen, who went swimming after the shark spotters closed the beach, knowing that there was a white shark in the area, the white shark bit him. And if we hadn't had shark spotters, there would have been many, many other situations over the last 8 years where people were in the water with white sharks on a close inshore, and it most likely would have had further shark attacks. So from that perspective, it's worked exceptionally well in my view, but it's never going to be 100% effective. It's vulnerable to all sorts of things, fatigue of the spotters themselves, missing something, it's very hard to look for sharks, tough conditions, very windy day, the water's murky, the water quality's not good, people don't respond to the alarm, they don't get out the water quick enough. So it's never going to be a program that at the beaches where it runs, it's going to be something that we would consider 100% effective. But from our perspective, it's a very effective program, and we think it achieves what it's intended to do. This is just an example of the data collection that they do. So they not only just capture the fact that there was a shark, they track the movements of that shark in the inshore area, what time, what were the weather conditions, how many people were then watered at the time. So you can see it's a really a great way to build a fantastic resource base and knowledge. And it also really shows the seasonal trend of white sharks. This is the Musaberg sightings over the number of years, and you see these very clear peaks during the summer period and troughs on those sightings during winter. And we know now more empirically or scientifically from Alison's work than that is in fact the case, that we have this inshore movement during summer and most of the sharks move off to the island around winter. Then the shark signage, we have three types of signs on our coastline. One is what we would call this the shark smart sign, and that's really informative. That's to tell you that white sharks occur in our waters all year round and gives you some safety tips as well as has the emergency numbers and what to do. Then there's the shark spotting sign, which tells you more around how the shark spotter program works, and that's only at the beaches where there is shark spotting. And they also have on the sign the ability to write on the sign on a daily basis the last sighting. So if you go down to the beach, you can see the last sighting in Musaberg was, in fact, on my SMS, was about half an hour ago. And they'll put that on the board so you know it's something that you're interested in, or if that it determines whether you want to go swimming or not, that information is there for you. And then a sign that took us quite a long time to get to, because we were really not that keen to go with these kinds of signs, is the sign on the right-hand side, which is the high-risk sign. And we've not deployed that sign in very many areas, but we did feel it appropriate eventually to put that sign up along Jaggers Wharf Official, because we do believe that there's a high-risk area because of the deep water that runs along Jaggers Wharf, and we felt it was only appropriate to put that kind of sign there to give people the appropriate warning from that perspective. So it's not a sign that we deploy or put out easily, and it's not something that we put up without some serious consideration as to the implications of a sign like that. And then from a research perspective, obviously there's not a lot of money to finance research, particularly around white sharks. Very difficult for people to do that research. They're very dependent on funding and grant funding. There's not a lot of agencies that employ people to do research. So from our perspective, it was very important for us through the shark spotting program to be able to give a sense of employment security to somebody to continue the inshore white shark research. Because from our perspective, the more we learn about white sharks on the inshore, the better for the community as a whole. So we funded the employment of a shark expert or shark scientist by the shark spotting program explicitly to focus on the inshore environment, to look at trends in terms of white sharks, so other things that we can pick up around water temperature and other environmental factors that determine their presence on the inshore, to collect all of the data that we get, and then also explicitly in the future, hopefully to run this research program around the exclusion. And so from our perspective, very important to have somebody, highly knowledgeable person to run that side of things, and to continue to build our knowledge base. And then from a information perspective, in terms of putting information out to the public, we do an annual, and some of these things I'm going to come back to when I tell you, talk about the challenges to this, we do an annual warning of inshore movement. So every August, we do a media release and a public statement reminding people that white sharks move into the inshore during the summer months, that season is upon us, that people should be aware of that inshore movement. We do that on an annual basis. Our shark spotters communicate daily through Twitter and Facebook and other media around shark sightings. So if you're linked into those kinds of things, you can get a message telling you that there was a shark sighting in Musaberg half an hour ago, one at Fishhook yesterday, the beach is closed, the beach is open, or whatever is going on. So that is open information at all times through all of those different forms of media. We do issue cautions for areas and put a standard caution in place, and that's where we are telling people fundamentally from our perspective probably don't go in the water for the time being, and we raise the red flag all of those beaches. And to give you an example, in October of 2011, we had three white sharks at Fishhook, 23 days out of the 31. And so in that scenario, we issued a general caution, and we feel it's appropriate in that regard where we know that the sharks are there, that they're almost daily, for people to be extra careful, and we make sure that the shark spotters fly the red flag, and we continuously reiterate that warning through the media and radio stations to try and get the message out to people. And then what we try and do is respond to all media queries and to be open and as honest as we can. So if the question is asked, we provide all of the information that we have. We don't hide anything. We don't pretend that a shark wasn't in the area. If we're aware of a shark in the area, we'll happily tell people if we feel that that is only appropriate and responsible to do so. And then the last thing that we do is, following a shark attack, our view is that because there's a lot of interest and speculation around these events, it's appropriate for us to collate the information relating to that particular shark attack as fast as we can to make sure that it's correct in terms of what absolutely took place, what were the surrounding environmental conditions, and to provide that report to the public as well. And we do that to try and make sure that the correct information gets out there and to reduce the amount of speculation and conspiracy theories that sort of emanate from that. And I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. And then the last thing is our intention, and we hope to be doing that shortly, is to trial an exclusion net at Fishhook. This is just an aerial photograph of the area that we're hoping to deploy an exclusion net. And then to reiterate, an exclusion net is not a shark net. An exclusion net is a net that is a small mesh net that the entire intention of the net is to prevent a shark entering an area. It doesn't entangle the animals, it doesn't catch the animals, it really works as an underwater fence. And our plan and our intention is to deploy that net in the morning and to retrieve it in the evening. So it's not in the water overnight where it's, there's potentially a little bit more risk for something to become entangled in the net, such as a whale or a seal, where we're not able to monitor it by our shark spotters. But it's really a fence. It's not a shark net. And we feel particularly at Fishhook that it's an appropriate area to trial it because it's, shark issues are having such an impact on Fishhook. And if we can get it right there, it becomes a safe space to really recreate the recreational use of that beach. It serves the lifesavers. And if we can get it right there, it may be something that we would be able to deploy to other areas where the conditions are appropriate and where the need arises. And if we can do that at little to no ecological cost, then we believe absolutely that it's in the public interest to try and get that right. So those are our intent, and that's what we've tried to run over the long period of time in terms of that context that I spoke about. And these are some of the challenges that that remain in terms of that approach. And I'll go through them now and then talk about them all in a little bit more detail. Is the intergovernmental management and responsibilities, which is a very difficult space for us to work in, and there's some pushing and shoving that takes place there. Often very strongly entrenched public perceptions, and very poor trust in government officials. And I don't take that personally, it's just more a statement of fact, and I'll talk a little bit more about that too. But I think also white sharks are globally an iconic species, and as a result we have many individuals who suddenly become shark experts overnight, who are on the media and newspapers and all sorts of claims, and are stating themselves very clearly as a shark expert, and often the information that they're providing to the public is incorrect. And we see that kind of peaks around a shark attack event or shark controversy, and a whole range of shark experts appear out of the woodwork with all sorts of statements. And those statements often get entrenched in the public view. As I said, I'm not going to talk too much more about it unless there are questions later. The exclusion net, again, to iterate, it's not a shark net. So we've said that, and I say it openly to all of you. We keep reiterating that to the public, but a lot of the response we still get from people is, how dare we put a shark net in Cape Town waters to kill the sharks? It's not a shark net, it's an exclusion net. And I'll talk about the complaints at the public warnings and the information that I spoke about that we provide. And then lastly is we still struggle on an ongoing basis, and my experience has been in 17 shark attacks is that when there is a shark attack, the primary thing that people are looking for is for us to provide a reason. Why did that shark attack that person? And I had a man in my office for an hour and a half asking me that question over and over again, even though I said to him, I cannot tell you why. He said, you have to tell me why. And I think it's a lot to do with this. If we can find a reason for why there was a shark attack, it allows us to act in the opposite direction of it. So if I was to say to you, that shark bit so-and-so at Fishhook because it was cloudy and raining on that day, that makes you feel better because you can just say, well, it's cloudy and raining, I'm not going to go swimming at Fishhook. So this is enormous pressure to determine a reason for shark attacks, and there are no reasons to the best of our knowledge. They're random events, it may be mistaken identity in some cases, it could be aggression in others, who knows what they are, but there's this enormous pressure for us to determine the reason for it, and if we can't come up with a reason, it's where the myths start generating. It's a result of cage diving. It was the O-Search research program. It's all these kinds of associated things, and that links into some of the points made in number three that I said, where the statements that are made perhaps unintentionally start becoming factual in people's minds, and once they become factual, very difficult for us to correct those facts, and more difficult when, as I said, as public officials, we're not trusted. So when we say that's in fact not true, by and large, my experience with the public is, no, you're lying. You're getting money from them, or there's some other reason for it, and that. So it becomes something that's very difficult to remove, something that's factually not correct, and I'll give some examples from the public's mind. So let me get on to those. So the kind of interagency or responsibilities, we have this very unique situation where the management of white sharks sits squarely with the Department of Environmental Affairs. That's the National Government for Environmental Affairs. They have no investment or have provided no both investment resources or effort in terms of shark safety, They manage the population, but they don't relate that to shark safety. The city does the shark safety side of things. And related to that, we see ourselves really as a receiving environment for a number of decisions that are made there that we are not participants in. So in many times when I have to speak around shark attacks, I have to address the issue of cage diving and chumming. We have no role in issuing those permits in any way. And that's not to say that I don't agree or disagree with cage diving, but it's really to make the point that you have this disjuncture between the management authority and the safety authority, and that they're not working in the same realm. And there's a disconnect between the way that we think about white sharks at a population scale and the way that we think about them from a public and safety perspective. And there's two very different spheres of government working very independently around that, and that's just the nature of how it's been separated out. And one of the issues that arises from that, from my perspective, is really there's a great disconnect in revenue and funding. So white sharks as a whole, from my perspective, generate a huge amount of resources commercially in South Africa on an annual basis, be it through cage diving, which is a massive industry, a number of documentaries filmed here, other types of films. There's a huge revenue generation related to white sharks. Very little, if any of that, is returned and reinvested into white sharks themselves, the research and the safety from people. So from my perspective, that's one of the biggest disconnects in this entire debate, is that we seem to be able to separate this massive revenue generating thing that's directly related to white sharks. None of that is returned into, in fact, it isn't returned into compliance monitoring either. So many of the things that are taking place in terms of cage diving is very little monitoring and compliance of those activities, yet that is a huge revenue generating perspective. And also very little of that, not none of it, little of it, is returned into active research and as well as the public safety effort. Poor trust in government officials. This is a direct copy of an email. I get many, many, many of these after each shark attack. The email says, so if you say that it was safe, why don't you go in and see it false bay with all the chum? You have blood on your hands, disgusting, but hey, this is what happens when money talks. So when there's a shark attack, we will get, myself directly, 10s, 20, 30, 40, 100 of these kinds of emails, and it speaks more directly to what I was saying. I don't take it personally, but if I tell somebody that it's not related to chumming, they won't believe me. They'll still say no, because money talks. You're somehow embedded with the cage divers. Particularly this email was related to the host search research program, which we as a city had nothing to do with. We're not part of that program in any way. But their perspective was that the host search program had brought a huge amount of revenue to Cape Town. We therefore all supported the chumming. As a direct result of the host search boat, David Lindenfeld was killed at Cool Bay. And no matter what I say to this person, I'm not going to change their mind. And part of that is, if I speak to you about now, is the examples where a lot of other people who are not directly involved in all of this go into the public realm and make statements around facts that are in fact incorrect. But once those are out there, we can't get them back, and that really shifts and shapes people's perceptions. Some other perceptions that remain challenging, the examples are shark flags. So after the fatal attack on Mr. Skinner at Fishhook, at the time we still had the four coloured flags, but the green, black and red flag didn't have sharks on them, they were just green flags. And one of the issues that was raised at the time was, if you're not from Cape Town, if you're from Germany or wherever you come down to the beach, you see a green flag flying, you don't know that it's got anything to do with sharks, or a red flag. If you don't read the signboards, you go for a swim and you didn't know. So what we did was we changed it, and we made it explicit that those flags are flying have something to do with sharks. So hopefully people would see that and go, let me find out what that's about, or let me read the signboard. So we put the shark figures on the flags. And we received a lot of kickback from that, from local businessmen saying, we cannot tell people that there are sharks in our water. If we put flags on the beach with sharks in them, we're going to scare people away. We need to kind of hide the shark spotting program. We don't want it to be visible. We don't want people to think that they're sharks. You need to be there but not seen. And from our perspective, our approach is the reverse to that. Is we want people to know that they are sharks. Because if you do know, you can make an informed decision. But that's the kind of thing that is an ongoing debate. In fact, it's still not yet resolved. That we're continuously getting that kind of kickback around those kinds of issues. And any effort from our shark spotting program to become more active on the beachfront is often opposed, because people don't want the message to be going out that there are sharks in our water. They would prefer people not to know. Because again, the perception is that is negative in terms of how people respond to our coastline. the public protector complaint. It's just an example. In 2004, a formal complaint was laid against me at the public protector for not removing the seals from Seal Island and taking them to Robben Island. I'm serious. And as a result, there was shark attacks and false bait because the seals were on Seal Island. So I had to respond formally to that complaint. And again, it's these huge... I don't know if you argue it's misconceptions, but it's those kinds of perceptions that we still confront and we need to change. And then anger at public warnings. As I said, every year in August, we issue a public warning that it's summertime, the sharks are moving inshore. Every time we do that, I get an enormous number of complaints from a range of commercial interests, which again says, please stop scaring the public. You're making a huge hype out of sharks. You're scaring people away from our coastline. You're making this into a Jaws movie, etc., etc., etc. So there's a number of challenges that we face in that regard on an ongoing basis. And then to speak a little bit about the shark expert phenomenon, in my own perspective, there's very few people in South Africa that should consider themselves shark experts. I'm certainly not one of them. There's a lot of people that I think could consider themselves shark activists, shark conservationists, all sorts of ranges. But in terms of really being an expert in shark behavior, how sharks work, how they operate on our coastline, and where they are, there's only a handful of people that I believe that have that information. And these are just some of the examples that we've had to respond to because people that have been given the logo as shark experts, and I'm not going to name anybody, but I'll use the examples that we had to deal with, their views become entrenched as something from a shark expert. And the one was from a very well-known person who was claimed to be a shark expert, was that we should tie helium balloons with a long string onto every shark's dorsal fin, and we will then see them swimming around False Bay and know where they are. And, honestly not making that up, it was a formal proposal. We have repeated requests to use dorlases as barricades across the entire Fishhook Bay, so to close it off like a giant tidal pool. And then also, on a more serious note, we have the deployment of shark shields and buoys in a line to act as a kind of shark exclusion net thing. And that's continued to happen irrespective of the fact that the very people that developed the shark shields, which is the Sharks Board, as well as the current manufacturers of the shark shields, have told people not to do that. It doesn't work. There's no evidence that they work in a line on a ring of buoys. But again, the point I'm trying to make, I'm not being judgmental on that. I understand people's nervousness and fear and looking to do something. But the point I'm trying to make in the shark world, or in this kind of complex space of the shark, people don't believe what I consider to be shark experts, what they tell them. Everybody seems to know better. And some of the direct things that, in terms of the incorrect information, and this relates to the O-Search program, it was provided to the media that there was 5,000 kilograms of chum being used in False Bay to catch and tag the sharks. That was immediately responded to, that it was incorrect. There was a permit, certainly, that they could carry 5,000 kilograms of chum on their boat, but under no circumstances would they ever, A, need to use 5,000 kilograms or put 5,000 kilograms of chum in the water. But once that information was out there, although it was factually not correct, it got stuck in the minds of everybody. We then had the fatal attack on David Lilienfeld, and that was the fundamental issue that we had to deal with, was you allowed 5,000 kilograms of chum in False Bay, and therefore you attracted sharks from outside of False Bay into False Bay, and that was why there's a shark attack. The fact that sharks are in our bay all year round, and in fact don't need to be drawn into the bay, it's where they were meant to be, is not absorbed by anybody else. It's this factual statement that is incorrect, but becomes fact and then has a life of its own. And linked to that as well is this continuous debate or thing that you have to respond to, where the cage diving at Seal Island is in fact the reason why sharks are in False Bay, is that little bit of chumming that they do attracts sharks to False Bay, which is absolutely incorrect. If you consider the scale and the amount of natural chum that comes off Seal Island, in terms of the number of tens of thousands of seals that live there, the huge stick of chum that comes out of Cork Bay Harbour on a daily basis, the hundreds of fishing boats that we have in False Bay, the very minute amount of chumming that the cage divers do at Seal Island in amongst all of that natural chum would almost be unmeasurable. But yet there's this ongoing perception that in fact that's what's drawing the sharks into False Bay. It's an incorrect perception, but to change that view is very difficult for us because it kind of gets cemented. And then with the fatal attack on Ms. Skinner at Fishhook, there was a claim that we had intentionally asked the shark spotters to step down so that the attack would happen, so that we could use that to generate further funding. And following on from that, there was a significant effort by members of the community to catch our shark spotter sleeping. So I would get these photographs taken at long distance of the shark spotter perceived to be not looking at the sea. So these, even though we say to people that the shark spotters are doing a great job, it's never going to be 100% effective. It's a very difficult job to sit and look at the sea for 6 hours. Even within that context, there's this belief that they were at fault. And the reason that there was a shark attack was because we had asked them to step down, or they were not doing their job. So in conclusion, I've spoken for a long time, so I'll wrap up. The point I'm trying to make is that sharks create this really unique human response. It's something that if we ignore that, in my view, ultimately at the cost of the shark, because if we don't do the right thing and try and create some degree of safety and some level of confidence in our coastline, and even if that fear is irrational, and in many cases it's actually not, but if it is, that cost will be to the sharks themselves at the end of the day. If we allow things to get out of control, and we have, although we can't directly control it, but if we do nothing and there's a number of shark attacks in a smaller space of time, my feeling would be is that the tipping point in Cape Town, we've already reached it on a few times, or come close to reaching it a few times. If we have a number of events in a small space of time, again, we can quite easily reach that tipping point, and that would be a very sad day from my perspective. Myths and incorrect information are entrenched and very hard to change. So a lot of the stuff I've spoken about today, I know absolutely that we will, unfortunately, have another shark attack in Cape Town at some point. And I know absolutely when that happens, the same things that we've responded to time and time again will again be put on the table. One of the key things is the white sharks, and this is a global perspective, but they are an iconic species. They're a little bit on a pedestal. People are really interested in white sharks. They have this kind of grand thing around them. And as a result of that, there's quite a contestation for the space around white sharks in terms of researchers being called a white shark expert, being involved in programs, being recognized globally as somebody who speaks on white sharks. And that kind of thing that you see attracted to any sort of iconic species sometimes tends to muddy the water a little bit. And as I said, very poor public trust in government officials. No matter what we say, we tend to be seen to be either hiding something, have a hidden agenda, or have some sort of interest in it in a different agenda. I don't judge that. I don't take it personally. I think it's something that is consistent across the public official spectrum. But it's just to highlight the perspective around some of the challenges that we face. So I'm not suggesting at all that today that should be fixed. And then for myself, just to simplify it down to the basic facts, is shark safety needed in Cape Town? And from my perspective, absolutely. And from a people perspective, most certainly. I'm absolutely certain in my own mind, if we did nothing in areas like Fishbeck and Musenberg, there would be an increase in the regularity of shark attacks. Linked to that as well, from my own perspective, I have a daughter. I would never allow my daughter to swim 300 meters out at Fishhook in summer. And if I feel that way about my own daughter, I cannot say to anybody at Fishhook from the Life Saving Club that it's fine for you to do training exercises 300 meters out at Jagger's Hall. So there has to be a fair play within that, and we need to do something to make that space safe again. And certainly from the last perspective around the people side of things, is my greatest concern would be is that if we reach that tipping point in Cape Town where we have a number of events in a short space of time and the public sentiment moves in the direction that requires a response that's not a response that we feel is appropriate, we will lose ecologically on a massive scale. If we move towards anything around culling, netting, or removal of animals in terms of population control, that would be a very, very sad day from a Cape Town perspective, but also from a global perspective in terms of white sharks. And then lastly, from my perspective, shark safety in Cape Town is also very important from a shark perspective, not just a people perspective. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much for that really fascinating talk. And Greg's going to take some questions.